In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman. Wonder Woman. Batman. Aquaman. And those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this episode is my super friend, writer of the wondrous Wonder Twins miniseries, Mark Russell. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Rob.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, totally my pleasure.
It dawned on me as I was getting to this issue of the series that this is the first solo, the backup strip is the first solo story featuring the Wonder Twins. And I thought, well, you know, I made my mind, you know, went out a little and I realized, well, geez, there was that Wonder Twins miniseries. That was really fun. I really enjoyed that series. And I was like, well, unfortunately, E. Nelson Bridwell no longer with us. And I thought, well, that means the second greatest authority on writing the Wonder Twins is you. So you'd be the perfect person to talk about the story. So again, I'm just so appreciative that you are here joining me in the Hall of Justice.
Well, I'm glad to be here. And I fear for history that I'm now the greatest authority on writing the Wonder Twins.
So before we get to this issue in question, which is Super Friends number 14, it was on sale July 18th, 1978. I want to ask you, Mark, like, what is your history with the Super Friends series? I mean, I'm imagining this came and went long before you were ever around. So how much of this have you read either by now or before you just got around to doing the Wonder Twins series?
Well, and this will probably give away how old I am. I actually was a huge fan of Super Friends when I was a kid. Like, I watched it in the 70s, and I think that's one of the reasons why when Brian Michael Bendis offered me the chance to write the Wonder Twins as part of his Wonder series that he was doing for DC, I sort of jumped at it, because to me, I mean, I think that a lot of people saw them as sort of a punchline or a joke, but to me, it's like they were kind of like the ones that you could relate to the most as a kid watching that show, because they were the ones who weren't expected to be perfect. You know, they could screw up. They didn't have to get it all right. And so to me, I thought they were a really good sort of analog for what I was going through as a kid. And I really wanted to like bring that same sort of sense to the characters when I was writing them.
Hmm. Did you read the comic book at all?
No, not really. I pretty much watched the one or two. I mean, I read some as research when I was writing the series, but my background and what I really wanted to bring to it was the sense I got from the TV show that I enjoyed when I was a kid.
When you were writing the series, were you sort of imagining those voices in your head? I mean, when I was reading it, I can't help but hear those cartoon voices as their. I mean, the dialogue obviously in your Wonder Twins series is a little different. It's a little more sophisticated. It's certainly a lot funnier. But I can, you know, when I can only think when I see the Wonder Twins, especially in their animated form, I hear those two actors playing. Those are the only voices I can think of. So I sort of could hear it in my head as I read the issues of your book.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's hard having grown up on that to not hear their voices as you're writing. But yeah, I definitely didn't want it to just be sort of a safe, tasteful homage to that too. I wanted to imbue it with my own sort of voice and my own sort of thoughts about what was going on in the world. Cause you know, back then they would have like the safety tips,
right?
You know, like don't play with a kite in a thunderstorm,
right.
Or, you know, don't hang from a power line or something like that. And they're kind of ludicrous because I didn't know anybody was doing any of those things. It didn't seem like so I wanted to write a series that was more about the sorts of problems that I think kids are actually going to face as they grow older. The fact that the economy's been rigged against them, the fact that that they're more likely to end up, that a lot of people are more likely to end up in prison than college. And,
working for Lex Luthor.
Yeah, or like working for Lex Luthor one way or another. Right. So I wanted to like make my stories more about the actual sort of dangers that would confront kids as they grew into adulthood.
Absolutely. Yeah, I said that's one of the things I really enjoyed about the series. It has all that Super Friends kind of goofiness to it, especially with some of the villains you came up with for that series. And we could talk about that in a little bit. But yeah, I said I thoroughly enjoyed it. I will say regarding the safety tips, the one I remember the most, the one that I folded into my life was there was one, I think it was Aquaman, where he tells people if you meet a dog, don't reach out to pet it on the head. You should reach your hand out to let it sniff you first. Because the dog will think you're being aggressive. And I was like, oh, I didn't know I was supposed to. And I incorporated that into my life after that. So thank you, Super Friends. Like
how would Aquaman be the one to know that?
Well, yeah, okay. I do have to wonder, why is Aquaman not in the Wonder Twins series at all? He's not even in the background. How did that happen?
Yeah, I think it's because it was mostly a land-based story. I had a hard time working him in. I wouldn't like to.
Mira's in the background, though, at one point. I was like, Mira's here. Where's Aquaman? What's that about?
Yeah, I would have liked to at some point.
Yeah, it's for anyone who hasn't read the Wonder Twins, by the way, it's an absolutely fantastic series. It's very, very funny. And as Mark talked about, there's a lot going on in the subtext and stuff, but it has all the Wonder Twins sort of silliness to it. And it's great to see them front and center, as we will see in the second story in this particular issue. So, okay. So let's talk about the comic book. It's, as I said, it's issue number 14. The story is Elementary. It's, of course, by E. Nelson Bridwell, Ramona Fraiden, and Bob Smith. Before we talk to the story, though, the cover. We've got Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman riding a giant bird, presumably, that is Jaina in her form. And they are being attacked by four strangely garbed villains. And one of them says, give them a taste of fire, Salamander. And we see the Salamander person is doing just that. And we see these other characters in the foreground. And they're all sitting on this giant tree as the three super friends, Aquaman and Robin, are missing. Approach. What do you think of this cover, Mark?
Oh, I think it's great. Very evocative. And it's, sort of a classic superhero story cover. I don't like superhero covers generally that show things that I think would be better as interior art, like mm-hmm. the things that are like middle of battle scenes or things like that, or there's too much going on. But this one, I think, is just sort of classically evocative.
It features – it's very busy. I mean, Ramona Fraiden was great at being able to to put
it
a
looks
lot.
Like the sort of cover I would normally hate is I guess what I'm saying, but it works for me.
And she also uses the classic comic book cover format where you've got the bad guys in the foreground, the heroes in the background. Joe Kubert did that a lot of war covers with like Nazis surrounding and they're looking down. And so it's a classic view to use. And yeah, it's very effective. And again, Ramona Fraiden was just marvelous at being able to cram in a ton of detail in a tiny space. I mean, you've got seven figures plus Jaina in bird form plus the origin of the Wonder Twins blurb. I mean, there's a lot plus cover copy. I mean, there's a lot going on here. So
those covers generally to me look like sort of like when you see like an all-star jam on like stage at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame,
right?
And it's like they're all kind of playing a little bit, so you can't really appreciate anybody's individual efforts.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Part of me too is like, if they're characters that aren't overdone, if they're characters that I think are more minor characters or in their sort of interesting, non-usual stations, then I think it's more interesting.
Yeah, I said it's a nice piece. It's always nice by Ramona Fraiden. Every issue and every month in the series, we're just singing her praises because she's just so wonderful in the book. So, all right, so let's get to the story in question. As I said, this issue was on sale July 18th, 1978. It opens in a restaurant inside the Wayne Building. Bruce Wayne is having dinner with five guests. He remarks that unlike he and his friend Sandor, the other four have become wealthy thanks to their own efforts, as opposed to inheriting a vast fortune. One is an author, another a singer, the third a couturier, the fourth a scientific inventor. Sandor mentions that while Bruce has turned to many philanthropic pursuits, he is now funding scholarships. He mentions a recent discovery of an unknown piece of writing by Paracelsus, the 16th century alchemist and the founder of modern chemistry. It involves the summoning of elemental spirits that supposedly inhabit earth, air, water, and fire. Bruce seems disinterested and quickly departs, leaving his guest to wonder if there's another girl waiting somewhere in Gotham. But of course, it just means that Batman is heading out on patrol. The next morning, the four super friends each discover gigantic gems suddenly appearing across the globe. Superman investigates the one in Metropolis, only to see it crack open, and inside is a man who calls himself the Gnome, Master of the Earth. Superman initially gets the upper hand, but then the Gnome transmogrifies the remnants of the crystal into kryptonite. On a beach, Aquaman has a similar experience, encountering a woman known as the Undine. Wonder Woman meets the Sylph, Mistress of the Air, and Batman encounters the Salamander. All three super friends find themselves outmatched by the being's strange powers. Back at the Hall of Justice, Robin and the Wonder Twins get word of the trouble. They split up to assist each hero. Zan becomes a wave and puts out the Salamander, and Batman is shocked to see underneath the mask it is Ginger O'Shea, one of the women he had dinner with earlier. Robin helps Superman, Gleek helps Aquaman, and Jaina helps Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman asks why Jean Gale is under the mask and has become a criminal. The woman says she's not really Gale, but a spirit inhabiting her body. Back at the Hall of Justice, the four spirits explain that they were given forms by the Overlord, who told them that the Super Friends were evil. The Fire Spirit then mentions that they now have come close to the chance to regain their souls. After 300 years, the elementals turn into mist, foam, dust, and ash, and they can live forever, though, if they inhabit material bodies. By doing this and fighting evil, they would succeed at living forever. The spirits temporarily return the bodies to the minds of their hosts, who explained that Sandor Fane performed an experiment on them regarding the manuscript he mentioned at dinner. Batman makes the deduction that Fane is the Overlord and that the Superfriends should go after him. The four helpless hosts, though, don't want to be superheroes. The Superfriends explain the spirits can take over their bodies whenever they want, so for now at least they can resume their normal lives and simply let the elemental spirits reside in them until a solution can be found. Wow. This is a lot for 17 pages.
Yeah.
What did you think of this story?
You could probably gather from your description of it, I thought it was a little convoluted. It was a lot to pack in. Although, kudos for, introducing a villain that was like tailor-made for Zan to take care of. it's like Zan's probably got to be just licking his chops waiting for these moments when he can take on a villain like the Salamander.
I mean, every issue, like we do with Ramon Afraid, every month on this show, we marvel about how much E. Nelson Birdwell could pack into 17 pages. I mean, could you imagine trying to write this much story in just 17 pages?
Oh, and you look at the pages too, and they're not like super busy. I mean, they're busy, but there's like five panels per page.
Yep.
It's fairly paced storytelling, and they're not like trying to have these like pages with like eight or nine panels that are, all just like talking heads. So it does a pretty good job of balancing, even though it is a very convoluted story of like somehow finding a way to tell a kinetic action-filled story with those restraints.
I love that you said, I think the opening is great with Bruce Wayne. Again, E. Nelson Birdwell always managed to find ways to, and we know that he was the sort of self-professed continuity cop over at DC Comics where everything had to fit in all together. And there are some mentions here that I think were sort of like eye-opening, like in the third page where Bruce takes off, where he acts like, oh, I don't care about this stuff with Paracelsus, I'm leaving. They mentioned Silver St. Cloud, which had just happened over in the Steve Englehart, Marshall Rogers run of Detective Comics. And so it was like, wow, E. Nelson Birdwell was bothering to keep up with that kind of thing.
Yeah, then, it includes some deep cuts for sure.
Yeah. Later on in the story, we find out that the Sylph elemental is Jean Gale, a pop singer who appeared in previous issues of Super Friends. So he brought her back, and they sort of established, like, okay, in the world of the Super Friends, she's this kind of Maria Muldaur, Joan Baez kind of person. And here she's – so I love that it could have been anybody, but he takes the time to make it Jean Gale, just bringing her back. And even Wonder Woman's a little nonplussed. She's like, why would you turn against us, Jean Gale? Like, we're friends. They're like, oh, I don't know, Wonder Woman. Somebody take over me.
That's a convenient excuse, isn't it? I want to use that one.
That's true, yeah. I mean, Nelson Birdwell was writing this comic for little kids. I mean, this book was explicitly aimed at 6-year-old, 7 years old. But I mean, good Lord, he's mentioning Paracelsus, this Greek, the father of the modern father of modern chemistry. I mean, there's a lot kind of going on here, and he expects little kids to keep up. And I think that was something that, even though when I was older, when I was a kid, I read Justice League. I didn't really get the perception that Super Friends was meant to be for younger kids. I think maybe on some level I did, but it didn't feel like it. I mean, there's a lot there's a lot going on here for out of real world stuff that E. Nelson Bridwell is expecting like a 7 year old to follow along with.
Yeah, and I think I noticed this a lot, especially in like sort of Silver Age comics or in Bronze Age comics, where you get people who are sort of like literarily frustrated. So they know they're writing for a target audience of like 9 or 10 years old, but they have higher, they want to like actually tell a story that would work for adults. They don't try to dumb it down too much, which I appreciate. I think when I was a kid, that's what the stories I gravitated to the most were the ones that sort of treated me like an adult.
Yes.
And just expecting me to keep up, because a lot of times you'd have to stop and actually like look something up in the dictionary.
Yep. Yep.
World Book Encyclopedia or whatever. But it made, to me, it lent to that writer's authority in the sense that like, this is a story that I need to learn. I need to read if I'm going to, you know, grow, if it's going to be something that I'm going to be a better person for having read this. It was like, you know, in a lot of ways, sort of like, you know, the reading James Joyce or something, but for kids.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've said over numerous podcasts that when I was a kid, and like, I remember Batman, when I was very young, Batman used the phrase modus operandi in a comic book. And I didn't know what that meant. And I went and looked it up, or maybe I even probably asked my dad more likely. But I mean, if that was important to me, because it was important to Batman, you know, like, oh, what does that mean? I want to be able to follow along with Batman's talking about it. And then I learned, oh, it's Latin. Yeah, yeah. It's like, that's great. So yeah, it made me want to go and learn. So, what do you think? I mean, E. Nelson Bridwell had a pretty rigid formula for these issues. I mean, he always broke the team, very Gardner Foxy, and that he broke the team up and always had them fighting different people. There was always,
yeah,
he was always managing that. Oh, one villain showing up in Metropolis. Another
one. That's a formula now like extends to like video games and stuff. There's all these sort of like, you know, split ups and sub quests, and then the team reunites, you know, for the final battle at the end. It's very much like, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that whoever designed the Final Fantasy video games or whatnot probably was a huge fan of these comics.
Oh, really? Is that's a thing in Final Fantasy? I didn't know.
Well, I think just the formula of like, okay, you have this team, and then they break up, or that they have these little sub quests they have to go on before they can get back to the main quest, you know. And to me, like that formula that they came up with in these comics is hugely influential on other mediums too. You see it all the time now.
So yeah, so we get Aquaman takes on this gnome guy. There's a little detail about that he mentioned the Overlord. He says the costume the Overlord furnished did not pass through the stone as easily. It is badly rent, which rent. I mean, that is not a word you see to me much. And you know,
that's literary frustration. It's like this person would want to write something, you know, like set in, you know, the Renaissance or, you know, in medieval Europe, but
yeah.
But they'll make do with their comics.
Right, right. So, Superman takes on Gnome, and Wonder Woman takes on the Yundine, but she transforms into a gorilla at one point. I didn't even mention that in the synopsis. And then Wonder Woman takes on the Sylph, and then Batman takes on a Salamander. I love that the Salamander can breathe fire out of her eyes and mouth. It's a pretty...
Oh, that's one of the best panels in the entire issue is when she's got like fire shooting simultaneously out of her mouth and eyes at the same time. It was like, whoa. And yeah, and at that point you're thinking, you know, it's like this, it's like if you hadn't called Zan already to deal with this woman, then you gotta call him now. In every way he seems like the perfect foil for Salamander.
Yeah, I try not to take, as everyone knows, Aquaman is my all-time favorite character. I try to take offense that Gleek is the one that helps Aquaman. I feel a little like, come on, really, Gleek?
Yeah.
But okay, you know, somebody has to. They got it the way they have to do it.
He just sort of like was the last one picked. Gleek.
Yeah.
Well, Gleek was like the last kid picked on the softball team, I think.
Well, like, you know, Aquaman doesn't need help from a monkey, but okay, all right, that's fine. We can deal with that. And I love the ending where I love how angry the four are when they learn that they are stuck being superheroes. There's this wonderful panel on the last page of the story where Superman is explaining, what choice have you? The spirits can take over your bodies at any time. And the three women especially have this really mean, they're like, they're really mad about having that they have to give up their bodies for these spirits, which of course is completely understandable. But I love in the world of DC Comics, you just got to live with it.
Yeah, no, it'd be weird if it were otherwise. If people were like, oh, well, I guess I'll be occupied by another spirit for a while.
They're like, we don't want to be superheroes, and like, well, you know, what can you do? Just most of the time, you'll have control of your bodies. Like, oh, oh, well, all right. I guess that's the way it's going to be here. All right, that's fine. But again, I love every little detail that Ramona Freyden sort of throws in, because you know, it's always just, she can do so much with so little. All she does is just the looks on the faces of the four of them. They're just sort of staring at Superman, and they're like frustrated about this. And she's able to just convey so much feeling with just not a lot of line work, which is
again, right.
I think it's remarkable.
Yeah, no, the facial expressions I think are really the key, especially to, you know, a comic like this that's got like all these characters and all this nuance going on. It's like the facial expressions really do a lot of the lifting for the storytelling.
Yeah, it's really, really beautifully with her. She's still one of the great masters of comic book art. So overall in this story, one of the things I like to go through at every issue is we have one thing we call the best friend. And that is like, which of the super friends sort of came off best in this story? So do you have an idea who you would nominate for the best friend? Like which of, if any of them kind of got like the best most moments to shine in the story?
You know what? It was a pretty good ensemble, but I'm going to say Aquaman, just because he got stuck with Gleek.
Okay. You're throwing him kind of a mercy.
Yeah, he was like the Michael Jordan on that team.
So fair. I always try to give it to Aquaman where I can. I in this one, I feel like it's Batman just because Batman gets the most to do. It opens the story with him and Bruce Wayne, although – and I like that, you know, they're doing that classic, he's doing that Bruce Wayne foppish thing where the minute Sandor Fane talks about the this document that he's got, Bruce is like, oh, I don't care about that. I'm out of here. And of course, he's immediately jumping into being Batman. But everybody's like, oh, he's off with Silver St. Cloud or he's off with somebody else. So he gets kind of the most. And I'd say of the four elementals, the salamander, and this will lead into the next section. Salamander is probably the most effective of the four in terms of her power set. She feels like the biggest threat of the four.
Yeah, she came off definitely the most menacing. I would give her the game ball for the right. Villains.
Well, right. So the next thing I always like to go through is would any of these villains, because so many of the Super Friends villains that ENB created were, if not one and dones, they were Super Friend only villains. You know, they debuted in this series and they never appeared again. So do you think any of these, and you did a little bit of that yourself in Wonder Twins with the Scrambler.
Yeah, I wanted to mostly create my own villains,
right?
Because that's like half the fun, I think, of writing a comic book, is being able to sort of come up with your own characters and give them sort of unique angles.
Yeah, I love that team of you know, sort of
Dracula,
Count Dracula, that was fantastic. So do you think any of these elemental characters probably could have had life outside the Super Friends, or do you think?
Oh, I think definitely the gnome.
Do you really?
Yeah, I think that they're not, because he was so great in this story, but just the concept just seems so. It reminds me a little bit of Mole Man in the Marvel universe. Is like somebody who just kind of like shows up and like either is like a sort of like a B tag along to some other villains, or just somebody who just sort of comes up, especially I think as a metaphor in modern comics, he could come back as, you know, somebody who's just sort of a troll, just somebody who isn't really a threat, but just sort of like is constantly getting in the craw of like the superheroes, the Justice League or something. I think that I would definitely, if I could write any of these villains into a script of mine, I would definitely choose the gnome.
Well, it's good to know. Well, you know, maybe if the Wonder Twins comes back, you can work them into the
age of internet trolling. I think you would make a really good metaphor.
That's true. Yeah, the name. Wow. Yeah, the name has you could convert it from gnome to troll.
Looks too. It's just like sort of like, you know, like this is a creep.
Yeah, he's just kind of a big jerk. He looks like he walked out of the Lord of the Rings set and stuff. So, yeah, I said of the four, the salamander seems the most super villainy because her costume is sort of the most, though she has those big sort of suction cup feet, which is a little goofy. Yeah. And then the Sylph and Undine kind of are less defined generally. But yeah, for the most part, I sort of picture these would only be in the Super Friends and maybe they wouldn't translate, but yeah, maybe the gnome, you know, who knows, but they could.
Yeah. Yeah. I see him as somebody who would not like, you know, come up with a plan to conquer the earth, but would like come up with a plan to like, destroy the lunchroom at the office. And that's what I kind of like about the characters, with like lower scale. They're not always, you know, thinking about the big picture, about like world domination or something.
Right. Yeah. They're not trying to get it. Yeah, they're not trying to get a giant blue beam come down and destroy the planet. They're small scale stuff.
They're content just to like sort of wreak havoc within their abilities.
Yeah, that's I can see that. So yeah, so that is the opening story for this issue. Now, of course, this issue is unusual in that it features a backup, and this issue of Super Friends was supposed to be the first of an ongoing giant size format for various DC comics, but this was right around the time of the DC implosion. So this was the one and only issue of Super Friends that was this extra length, and it has this Wonder Twins backup. Again, we'll get to in a moment. But if you go and go to Mike's Amazing World and you look up the history of the Super Friends, the very next issue of Super Friends is back to its normal format with no backup. The prices jump back. This issue is 50 cents after the previous issue being 40 cents, and then the next issue is 40 cents again. So this was basically a one-off where Super Friends was an extra length book.
I hope it wasn't the fact that the backup story was about the origin of the Wonder Twins that killed off the idea.
No, I think, unfortunately, I think that DC implosion just ruined everything across the line, and they realized they couldn't pump out these extra length books. But so anyway, this is, we have the second story, and it's the origin of the Wonder Twins. It is also written by E. Nelson Bridwell, not drawn by Ramona Freyden. Now, here it is drawn by the great Kurt Schaffenberger, inked by Bob Smith, again, doing double duty. Now, this backup story, it's interesting is that it opens up on this last page of the previous story. They are directly connected, which I thought was a nice touch.
It was good, but yeah, it kind of confused me at first. Like, whoa, is this actually, you know, it made me think that it was going to tell more, it was going to be more about the
elemental
characters in the first story, and then they just sort of drop that.
Yeah, they just wander off. So he said, picking up where the first story left off, the four friends of Batman remark how they never wanted to be superheroes or have powers, something they doubt the Super Friends have ever experienced. The Super Friends agree, but then the Wonder Twins chime in that there was a point where they wished they were rid of their powers. The Wonder Twins explain that ages ago on their home planet of Exor, there were two races, normal humans and those who could shapeshift. Eventually, the races intermingled and the shapeshifting ability became more rare. Young Xana Jaina, though, did have the power to change, which became an issue only after a plague hit Exor, killing their parents. Xana Jaina get adopted by the Exor equivalent of a circus owner who put them on stage as an attraction. They were befriended by Illic the Laughmaker, a clown who trained the monkey known as Gleek. Illic tells them as shapeshifters, they are considered freaks and will never lead lives of their own. After using their powers to transform into the scariest things they could conceive, they demand back pay from their adoptive father. He agrees, but all they ask for is a spaceship. They take off to a remote part of Exor, and that is where they stumbled upon the supervillain known as Grax, plotting his plan to destroy the universe. Now happy with their lives, the Wonder Twins muse they might return to Exor one day, but only if they can lead the lives they desire. The four elemental hosts wonder if they will ever get used to the idea of being taken over occasionally. Robin says, if they can't get an exorcist to help him, maybe an Exor sister will. Batman groans at the Boy Wonder's awful pun. All right, so Mark, what did you think of this story of the origin of the Wonder Twins?
Well, it's very different than the one I came up with.
A bit.
Yeah, a little. And I was kind of disappointed that they took the opportunity to turn Exor into more of an ordinary place where not everybody. I always try to think that when you have an origin story on another world like Krypton or something, you should try to make that world as exotic and as unlike Earth as possible, at least in the trappings of that planet, so that, you know, it seems, you know, it's like you've opened it feels like so you have a sense of awe, like as if you had a door open to another realm you'd never considered before. And Exor seems a lot like Earth. Mm-hmm. Although I did, in creating my own origin story, I did borrow some of that, and that Exor had this period where it was much more like Earth in the sense that it was subject to, like, dictators and authoritarian rule and demagoguery and stuff, but they got over it and they became like this utopia, and everyone goes into like these shape-shifting cycles and everyone has these powers, and it's a much more idyllic society in my origin. So I would have liked to have seen it be a little more sort of otherworldly in the origin story. But that said, it was I kind of like the fact that like they were brought in by this impresario, this circus guy who then tried to turn them into an attraction. And that, you know, it's a perfect explanation of how they came upon Gleek.
Mm-hmm.
In my Super Friends, Gleek is also a circus monkey, but he's a circus monkey on Earth who they meet on Earth, as opposed to like being an Exorian circus mm-hmm. monkey. I guess makes more sense because he's blue.
Right. I was surprised at how kind of grim the story is. Again, it's aimed at small children, but I mean, their lives on Exor are pretty bad. I mean, this guy, this person that adopts them is presumably supposed to sort of take care of them and care for them. I mean, first of all, a plague killing their parents is like, wow, okay. And then they get adopted by this guy, and then he just treats them like they are property. And then the Illic, the clown, tells them, you're never going to have a normal life. You're just always going to be under this guy's thumb. I thought, boy, that's pretty dark stuff, again, for a story aimed at very small children. Yeah.
Which, I like that. I like the fact that, you know, you don't talk down to kids and you sort of present them with this sort of story, just expecting them to be able to handle it. Which, you know, I feel like when I was a kid, I handled much darker stuff with characters dying or characters facing, you know, being kidnapped and murdered. And dealt with it just fine. I don't know why we seem to think that kids aren't ready for to deal with like the tragedies they're going to discover in life, especially in this sort of bloodless, goreless, sort of safe medium.
Mm-hmm. As drawn by Kurt Schaffenberger, it does give the whole thing a more comical feel because yeah. His style was that way. So it doesn't seem quite as bad. But I mean, yeah, when I was reading, I was just like, boy, these poor kids have had kind of a rough life. You know, I mean, like their parents died when they were very young, and then they just got immediately sort of enslaved. I thought, boy, this is kind of.
Yeah, you think about it, it's not any darker or worse than like Roald, the what frequently happens, like Roald Dahl stories.
That's true.
So I think that's the way you sort of give kids a sense of their own sort of tragedy or their own sort of disappointment with their lives, and show them the lives of characters they admire, which are in a way even worse.
Did you find the backstory about how some of the Exorians have powers and some don't to be a little convoluted? It was like some of them don't have power, some do, and then eventually they intermingled and they bred it out, and there was a recessive gene, and I thought it seems kind of complicated. I mean, yeah. Couldn't you just say there was a strain and why? There was a strain on this planet that have powers.
It was like a lot of panels to basically do the work of what could have been done with a single caption, which was like, on Exor, where occasionally mutants have the ability to shapeshift into animals or inanimate objects. Right. You know, then that would have done the work of like having to explain the genetics and the history of like this shapeshifting, especially since you only got like 8 pages.
Right, yeah. I mean, they don't have a lot of time here. One detail I thought was funny is that it's on page 2 of the story where we see this flashback of these elder Exorians looking at some kids playing, and the man, the older guy with the beard, he has this headband that is the same color as his tunic, and I realized that is like the standard space alien uniform across DC Comics because that's what they dress like on Krypton too.
I remember thinking when I saw that, like, this is I'm sure I've seen something like this in like the Krypton artwork of, you know, like John Byrne.
Yeah, it's just like a standard uniform for aliens in the DC universe. The sequence where the Wonder Twins decide to be turned into the scariest things they can find, and Jaina turns into a Sarmonin, which is a Exor only creature, which has kind of looks like a sort of like Battle Cat from Masters of the Universe with sort of reversed colors with these big tusks and a horn. And then poor Zan, the scariest thing he can think of is a storm cloud where he turns into a storm cloud and he starts shooting lightning bolts at the people that might presumably buy the Wonder Twins. And I like that you've got these aliens and this one guy goes, lightning, yee, we'll be killed. And I thought, wow, do they not have lightning on Exor? I mean, although they know what it is.
Yeah, maybe it's like lightning with this that's controlled by this intelligence. That's really scary.
I guess so.
Which, kudos to Zan because when you're thinking about your greatest fears, things you're most scared of, not many of them are water-based.
That's true.
kind of hard to come up with something menacing. So he did a good job with the limited tools at his disposal.
I did kind of roll my eyes at, like, boy, how stupid are these people that they got scared by lightning? But I'm like, you know what? Here on Earth, do we have that much room to brag about how smart we are? I don't think we really do. So, like, who am I to judge the Exorians at this point?
Yeah, and I think, like, intelligent lightning, like, inside, like a closed area like that would be actually pretty terrifying.
That's true. That is true. Yeah, we've had some lightning bolts outside our apartment here in the parking lot, and it's a pretty powerful thing to behold. So yeah, you're right. Maybe indoors that would be pretty terrifying.
Yeah, I probably would split out of that room the second the Jaina turned into that Saruman
thing or whatever she is. And then I like how the story winds its way back to Super Friends number 7, which was the three-parter that introduced the Wonder Twins, which is where they find Grax and he is planning his whole plot, and that led to the beginning of the Wonder Twins as characters in the series. And then it ends with this horrible joke, which feels like it was written almost like for the cartoon. You can almost see them delivering this gag on the cartoon with the wah 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 music, and you've even got Batman doing like a Charles Nelson Reilly, where he's put his hands on his cowl and he's just like, "Oh, Robin." It's just like, okay, I think that Batman is just kind of willing to, like, or we'll do our blackout, and then, you know, that's it. We're done for this story. When you read this, how do you feel? Like, do you feel like anyway, is there anything you would have wanted to try in your Wonder Twin series, or you were just happy to?
Yeah, you know, I like the story of them, like, being in a circus, of them being sort of put on display, and like the irony is that they would have to come to Earth, a place where nobody has superpowers, in order to be accepted as normal. but yeah, I like the idea of, like, I always like these characters in comics, these sort of impresarios, these sort of con men who don't really have superpowers, they're just taking advantage of people. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like that's like a much more realistic and malevolent threat in the world than like somebody who can just destroy planets. Or,
right.
So, and plus they have to use their imagination. But yeah, I didn't like the idea that like Exor looked so much like, it was sort of underwhelming. Did not look like another planet to me very much at all, other than obviously the fact that they have pointed ears.
So when you got the Wonder Twins assignment, were you just free, given carte blanche to sort of just create your own thing? You didn't have to worry about, I mean, obviously, because the Wonder Twins were really not in any sort of DC continuity in any real way. So you could just do whatever you wanted to do?
Yeah, pretty much. They said, don't worry about the Super Friends cartoon continuity, because all that is kind of barbaric. It's not really DC anyway. The only sort of caveat they gave me was that there were certain characters that were in that the Hanna-Barbera TV series that they couldn't use because they were the intellectual property of Hanna-Barbera and not of DC. For example, like Black Vulcan, because he was a stand-in for Black Lightning.
Right.
Because they, for whatever reason, they couldn't get the rights to Black Lightning, so they created an analog for the Hanna-Barbera cartoon. So I had to be careful when I was using characters from the original TV series not to use ones that were owned by Hanna-Barbera. But other than that, they let me basically recreate the story and however way I saw fit, because they, you know, when you're writing the Wonder Twins, you're not exactly, you know, messing with the crown jewels. You know?
Right. I was very happy to see El Dorado walk by in one panel, because he was always one of my favorites.
That was something I consciously wanted to do, is I wanted to spend some time with the minor characters from the Super Friends cartoon and just give them like little cameos in the story when I could.
Now, all the visual gags, there's a lot of visual gags in that series, a lot of things on posters or little details. Is how much of, did you write all that in and that was put in on your behest, or was that partly the contributions of the artist or anything like that?
Yeah, it was mostly me. I mean, I think obviously the thing that sells it, the thing that makes it work, is the visual. And those were all Stephen, what he came up with. But yeah, usually I would write like little gag posters of like them trying to like sell like senior pictures half off, or like trying to sell like pharmaceutical drugs to depressed kids
in
the schools, stuff like that. But Stephen really did an excellent job, I think, of bringing them to life with the sort of visuals he came up with to accompany them.
Yeah, it's a beautiful looking series. I mean, it's colored beautifully, drawn beautifully, and he said it is a lot of fun. I mean, I'm sure anyone who's listening to this has read it, because I said it was great to have the Wonder Twins finally sort of in a DC comic and given their own series, for Pete's sakes. I mean, geez, is that anything that you would ever want to do more of if you got the chance, or write like some sort of Super Friends series if they ever did that kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, I would love to go back and revisit the Wonder Twins. On issue 12, the last issue that we did, we actually kind of left it open-ended in case mm-hmm. we did want to come back. They create this new organization that's for problems that can't be solved by superheroes, that sort of require people with intelligence and scientific knowledge and imagination to solve, that necessarily they can't necessarily be solved with super strength or flight or any of these things. And they called it Asterisk because it's for all the other problems that the Hall of Justice can't deal with. And so I'd like to go back at some point and tell a story around the operations of this new organization, Asterisk, that deals with problems that, I guess, which superpowers are kind of limited.
Right. one of the things I really appreciate, this will be the last thing before we sign off here, is I wanted to say is you wrote, I've read a lot of Superman comics over the years, over the decades I've been reading comics, but I really enjoyed your take on Superman, which was a kind of a slightly resigned one, which I liked a lot, where he was sort of acknowledging that some of the things are just so frustrating to deal with, and we have to just sort of do the best we can. But because the Xana Jaina feel overwhelmed by all of the stuff that's going on out there and all of the grim things, and Superman's like sort of, yeah, I know those things are out there and we have to just deal with them. But he was like a really patient father. And I really like that take on him. I mean, I don't think I've really seen that too much in other series. I mean, obviously the relationship he's going to have with the Wonder Twins is that of a sort of fatherly, because he's training them along with the rest of the Super Friends. But it just sort of like, it made Superman to me a little more human, that he's, you feel like this is a Superman and occasionally just kind of goes, it is what it is.
Yeah, he's like a cop who's been on the job for like 20 years, and the Wonder Twins are like the idealistic rookies who come on the beat thinking they're gonna change the world on the street, and Superman has to break it down about how much more complicated life on Earth is than what they're thinking. And the Wonder Twins in my version are sort of like Alexis de Tocqueville was to early American democracy. It's like sometimes you need an outsider to see who you are clearly. And so I think that in a lot of ways, the Wonder Twins have the view of life on Earth that I think we'd have if we weren't knee deep in it. But Superman is kind of like the one who sort of bridges bridges that with the wisdom of experience.
Yeah. I said it's a truly great series, and I recommend it to anybody that enjoys the Super Friends. Again, how could it not? It's the Wonder Twins getting their shot at being the star. So I think that's going to do it for this recap. Mark, thank you so much for coming by. This really meant a lot to me, because, as I said, you are the authority on the Wonder Twins. So there you go.
I wear that crown humbly.
So why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Best place is on Twitter. I'm at Manrus, M-A-N-R-U-S-S. And that's where I keep all my updates of what I'm doing with DC and other comics that I'm writing.
All right. That's awesome. Again, thank you so much for stopping by. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. You're going to stay tuned. We're going to run some commercial announcements. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Which is the hottest Marvel character?
Iron Man.
Ant-Man.
I can't decide between Professor X and Magneto, so both.
Loki.
Is Wolverine Marvel?
What about White Tiger?
What about White Tiger?
Doc Samson.
Doc who?
Star Fox.
That's a video game.
The girls go on a journey to determine every Marvel character's hotness in Ohotmu or Not, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe podcast you didn't know you wanted. Available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Our dream house.
Yeah. Can't wait to move in.
Let's send everyone our new address.
But the house won't be ready for 6 weeks.
Look, we want our bank statements on time.
Yeah.
And our credit card.
Yeah.
And charge account bill.
You're right.
Your post office has a free change of address kit with cards to tell everyone exactly when you're moving.
Better make sure you tell everyone our right address.
Get the change of address kit from your post office or mailman. It makes things go smoother after you move.
And we're back with listener feedback from all you super fans out there. And this is feedback for All Mankind, episode 13, with my guest, Terry O'Malley. And these are going to be the comments from the website, FrienWaterPodcast.com. First up is Matt Sorois, who says, always look forward to a new episode of For All Mankind. I get to experience a classic comic for the first time. As Rob pointed out, there is no villain this time around, as would sometimes happen in the cartoon. There are plenty of fun episodes where the super friends use their powers to stop a natural disaster or a monster run amok. I'm glad this transferred over to the comic. I had a light bright too. Unfortunately, my biggest memory is stepping on one of the pegs that had been dropped into the thick carpet, and it broke inside my foot, almost as bad as stepping on a Lego. Ooh. Chris, I really hope those Etch-a-Sketch overlays pop up in a future For All merch kind. I remember having those. Finally, as far as both Marvel and DC superheroes appearing together in merchandise, the last time I recall seeing this was in the early 80s building/construction toy Fiddlesticks. My younger brother had a deluxe set that came with Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, and the Hulk figures. That's amazing, Matt. I never had that. I don't think I'm even familiar with Fiddlesticks, so... that's cool. I got to look that up. That's really neat that they were still in the early 80s, still doing DC Marvel characters intermingled. That would be fun to find out, like, what was the last piece of merchandising that featured Marvel and DC heroes together. I'll have to check that out. Thank you so much, man. We have another comment from a Net Administrator who says, nice recap. Still hoping you all one day do an ENB podcast on Mr. and Mrs. Superman. It has that same Super Friends goodness of being a grab bag of trivia, tight plots, and great characterization. Well, you know, you never say never here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And I know that there are fans of that strip. So who knows, an administrator, might happen one day. Ada Boznar says, your image gallery reminded me that I also had this issue with the Whitman logo. Got it one of those three packs, along with a few more issues of Super Friends from around this time. The only thing I really recall about this issue, though, is Dr. Mist, especially that last page when he explains the angry-looking bust on the mountain. That is some really weighty stuff for a book aimed at the littler kids. But it sure stuck with me after all these years. And man, that light bright jingle song. It's such an annoying earworm. It was running through my head for hours after listening to the show and still is. Sorry, Ado, but yeah, it is quite light bright making things alive. I'm sorry, I don't mean to say. Sean M. Meyer says, hey guys, thanks for another great episode. Terry, your research is much appreciated and adds great information to the podcast. I really like tales like this where it's not so much of a true to-be-continued two-parter, but more of a here's what's happening now because of what happened last issue story. I was a bit disappointed by the cover of the issue, number 13, because it closely resembles the vastly superior cover to number 10, The Monster Menace. Rob, you mentioned that you weren't sure if kids would understand what a burrow is, but I think they would have, but not because of a mole, but because of rabbits. Even without seeing Watership Down, I knew that rabbits lived underground in burrows, although I grew up in a very rural area, so maybe city kids wouldn't be familiar with that term. I love Dr. Mist in the issue and how different of a character he is to the other superheroes at the time. Of course, I wouldn't have known it then, but then he was paired up with the Global Guardians later. He just became even more cooler in my mind. Regarding the expertly crafted panel of Wonder Woman with her hair blowing in the wind, perhaps because Ramona was a female artist, she had such a much deeper knowledge of how wind would affect someone in real life and brought that into her artwork. I did find it odd that when all the super friends were staring at the spirit of life and saying what they wanted most, not a single one wished for an end to violence or world peace. Regarding the super friends' light bright refill pack, I've included a link to an eBay auction that has a picture on the back of the pack that shows each of the 12 sheets and what they look like when they're pegged and lit up. And Sean does provide that link. Thank you very much. Again, you can see it over on the website, FrienWaterPodcast.com. Eric says, I got the impression that their reactions to the flame weren't so much general fondest wishes as they were the specific temptations that immortality had held for each of them. I didn't quite see that, Eric, but now it makes a lot of sense that you say it. But yeah, really, maybe not so much wishes, but just what could they do with immortality, which of course is a dangerous thing to wonder. So thank you. Mark Baker writes us, I had the same impression, but one does admit that what would one do with immortality and fondest wishes might as well be a subtle line. Rob, I'm surprised you weren't more upset by the way Superman was so condescending in his thoughts about Aquaman in the sequence. Well, I gave Aquaman a chance to take the beast on, and he flopped. I had a feeling I'd be the one who had to make the capture. Gee, Supes, thanks for giving me a chance. Not. If the mole's a threat, don't waste time giving the other guy a chance. Just get him. Yeah, I should have probably commented upon that. But yeah, Superman does kind of undervalue Aquaman a little bit. But, you know, he's Superman. We know that he can be a super dick sometimes. Cellar Dweller says, ending the old year with a new podcast. Thanks for taking the time during the holidays to do this. I remember reading this as a kid and thinking that Superman had an attitude problem after his thought bubble saying Aquaman flopped and that he'd be the only one to make the capture. I was secretly happy when Supers failed. I enjoyed seeing the Wonder Twins carry out Batman's plan, but Zan walking around as a snowman was just so, to me, dumb. He couldn't have turned into a cloud or steam or mist and just floated around. There were definitely some deep thoughts in this issue, but I appreciated them. Kids have their own deep thoughts at the time, so seeing it addressed in a comic was cool. Nick's thoughts about Wonder Woman and Robin referring to each other as Diana and Dick. It makes sense. Those are their names, but it just seems odd to me. Okay, fair enough, Cellar Dweller. Doug Van Diver says, Rob, is there anyone in your family named Machine Gun Kelly? Because that'd be totally boss. You know, I don't know of any, but I can look in some of our photo albums, Doug. I'll get back to you. The Light Bright toy itself isn't to blame for being lame, I think. It's just when you learn that the Mist family down the road has a much snazzier Light Bright than yours, it can whirl around and do fireworks and give you superpowers, that suddenly your own Light Bright doesn't seem as awesome. Oh, they're nice folks and all. It's just that the dad's a doctor so they can afford all the best toys. And it's his prerogative to have a man cave where he keeps cool stuff away from the riffraff. That's okay. We can be happy to make a picture of a clown with our own Light Bright. Thank you, Doc. Dr. Ann says, I had to chuckle at almost all the Dr. Mist in this issue. First off, the scowling mountain base. That's ridiculous. So much for a secret headquarters. But I laughed at the reminder that he was on Constantine the show. We do live in miraculous times. After all, in season one of Supergirl, a miracle she got her own show, we had a Reactron episode. A live-action Reactron. Amazing. Yes, and we do live in marvelous times. Martin Gray for the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog says, I remember reading this as a kid and being surprised that Superman had to ask if that was Dr. Mist at the head of the mountain. Who else would it be? It may have been a letter call or a Roy Thomas text page, perhaps a fanzine, but I read that Dr. Mist, a.k.a. Nomo, was based on an H. Rider Haggard character. Looking it up, that's Newt, the occult master, in Wisdom's Daughter, one of the She-Cycle. That would go with the magic flame bit in this issue. It's interesting that several of the hero's fondest wishes were connected to immortality, but this story was telling us immortality wasn't so hot. Batman's hope to fight crime for centuries was picked up on by Scott Snyder. Well, at least he had the same idea, who had him reincarnating in a series of bat clones. It's best forgotten. As ever, the art is lovely. Dr. Mist looks like he's wearing a miner's helmet, which would go over with the Burrow theme. I think Burrow was one of the first words I ever learned. Toddler picture books were full of them. Anyway, it was a fun issue. And I love Frosty the Snowzan. Put me down as a very jealous of whoever gets to guest next time, as it's a total winner, and they'll be back for the sequel to number 15, the issue with the one of the best male superhero costumes ever. Well, as you've seen here, Martin, the guest, my very special guest was Mark Russell. We're going to have a different guest for number 15. So as I said in previous episodes, when it's a sort of two-parter or it's a two-parter, I try to have the same guest for both parts, but sometimes I am also willing to change it up. And so we will have a different guest for the next issue for the sort of quasi part two of this story. And then in the comments, Eric came back and said, this was the first issue of Super Friends that I bought as a kid. Fond memories. Dr. Mist is indeed based on the character Newt from H. Rider Haggard's novel, Wisdom's Daughter. In the original Who's Who 2-page Global Gardens entry, when it lists the character's first appearance, it says, the man we now know as Dr. Mist first appeared in Chapter 18 of Wisdom's Daughter by H. Rider Haggard. As E. Nelson Brittle is one of the contributing writers for Who's Who, I'm certain that he wrote that entry and made it into canon. I was pleasantly surprised by the mention of The Complete Werewolf by Anthony Boucher. I remember reading that story and enjoying it very much. It had its own set of rules for lycanthropy. It's not a matter of being bitten. It's that some people have the potential to assume an animal form by saying the magic word. I can't recall for sure whether it was only a certain group of people or whether this potential was in everybody. Each individual has their own alternate animal form. Some people are werecats, werebirds, etc. The title character is a college professor named Wolf Wolf. Talk about nominative determinism. Derisively nicknamed Wolf Wolf by his peers, who encounters a stage musician with real powers who recognizes his potential. After being given the magic word, which is never revealed to protect readers who might try it out and die after becoming werefish, he changes into a wolf, but retains his full human intelligence and personality. He doesn't become wild or violent because he's just because he's a wolf. The drawback is that, being unable to speak, he has to hear someone else say the second magic word, Absarca, to change him back, which causes problems if the magician isn't around to say it for him. Whew! And that's like E. Nelson Brubo level plotting. No wonder he enjoyed that story. Thank you, Eric, for the detail. Scott McFadden, a new commenter, says, Hi, Rob. I've been listening to your podcast since the beginning, and I thought I would finally drop you a line. I admit that at first, I was a bit disappointed to find that it wasn't about the cartoon show, but I decided to keep listening anyway, and I'm glad that I did. I was vaguely aware of the Super Friends comic book, even read an issue or two back in the day. I'm ashamed to say that at the time, I probably found it a bit babyish, as it was clearly aimed at younger readers. Thanks to you, I'm now able to appreciate the charm of EMB's writing and Ramona Fraiden's art. In particular, I was unfamiliar with Ramona Fraiden before this podcast. I was more of a Marvel guy as a kid, and she did very little work for Marvel. But now I seem to see her name everywhere. What really moved me to write was to throw in my two cents about Anthony Boucher. Though I'm sure you've touched base with Chris Feinken by now about Boucher's career, I will just throw in my own familiarity with him. While I'm not familiar with the werewolf story you mentioned, I know Boucher mainly as a mystery writer. Besides his short stories, he wrote almost every episode of the Sherlock Holmes radio show that Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce did at the same time they were starring in the classic movie series. Reportedly, Boucher had an encyclopedic knowledge of the Holmes canon. The Anthony Awards, an annual award for mystery writers, is named after him. That's amazing. Thank you, Scott. I didn't know any of that. I've never even heard of this guy before. So that's really good. What an amazing and I don't think I even knew that there was a Sherlock Holmes radio series with Rathbone and Nigel Bruce. I'm learning all sorts of things. Speaking of Chris Franklin, he leaves a comment. Actually, I wasn't aware of Boucher or his werewolf book. Now I want to be. I think the werewolf books I banged on about were Jeff Roban's Return of the Wolfman that eluded me for decades. But a certain Mr. Van Diver was nice enough to send to me. And Frank J. Dello Stritto's A Werewolf Remembers, The Testament of Lawrence Stewart Talbert. Always a pleasure to hear Jerry's voice on the network, and not just in my head, playing the House of Frankenstein theme. This Christmas version was indeed a treat, and that alone makes me want to do another Christmas special next year just to be able to use it again. Perfect. Thank you, Terry, because we all need more House of Frankenstein. I have never read or owned this issue. Thanks for the great coverage. When Dr. Miss returns later in the series, I was flummoxed by his angry-faced HQ. I think Ryan Daly had a similar mountain sanctuary erected after seeing The Last Jedi. Thank you, Chris. Little Russell Burbage ends the comments with a few random thoughts. I think Ian B. himself explained Dr. Miss's origin, maybe in the letter column about this issue. I definitely remember him writing somewhere about getting the idea from H. Rider Haggard's novel, because at the time I read that I misunderstood him to be referencing L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology. Boy, was I confused. Likewise, I seem to recall Ian B. writing somewhere that he was not related to the author of Clifford the Big Red Dog. As a fan of that series and the Super Friends, I definitely remember wondering if they were related. This is an issue I remember not liking very much as a kid, but when I reread it, liking it a lot. It is definitely not in the same league as the Menagerie Man issues. Ha! I still don't care much for the attitude of Superman, though. That big stuff shirt. As everyone probably knows, Russell is a giant Aquaman fan, too. That's how him and I became friends over back when I was doing my Aquaman Tron blog. So, yes, I could see why he would also be offended at Superman's Aquaman bashing in that story. I really should have mentioned it. I apologize. That is going to do it for the comments. Again, For All Mankind gets a ton of feedback, and I really do appreciate it. The conversations are just so fun over on the website, and I'm glad I get to relate them all to you here on the show. It just means the world to me that so many of you are listening and following along to the show. Big thanks to Mark Russell for taking time out of his schedule to talk with me about the Wonder Twins. As I said, his miniseries is just very fun. I can't imagine anyone who listens to this show hasn't read it, but go out and check it out. It's very much in the style of the Super Friends. It's got that warmness to it, but as Mark pointed out, it's also got some nice commentary, and it is definitely set in our modern times and how it would work with the Wonder Twins being new young superheroes in the America in the 21st century. So I heartily recommend it. And again, I really appreciate him stopping by to talk Wonder Twins with me. It was just super exciting. So again, that is going to do it. Of course, if you want to follow the show, go to the website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Amazon Music. We're always talking to the Super Friends over on Twitter at For All of Mankind SF. And then finally, if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Chuck Dill and Stanford M. Brown for their support of For All Mankind. I really do appreciate it. So that is going to do it. Thanks for listening to For All Mankind. Join us next episode. We will look at Super Friends number 15, The Overlord Goes Under.
An FWTV podcast.